Hey folks, welcome back once again to Indaba Africa. This is Chris coming to you live from central Pennsylvania, quite a ways off from where my guest is at today in South Africa. Well, listen, I'll tell you, sometimes you get lucky. I reached out to Steve Hofmeyer and within 24 hours, he agreed to be a guest on the channel and I was able to track him down. This guy is like a unicorn. I'm telling you, it's hard to get a hold of him. When he came to DC, I tried to reach out, but he had more important people to talk to. That's not being facetious. That's a genuine comment. So I couldn't reach him when he came back over. He probably never even knew that I reached out to him. But I've been trying to get him on the channel now for about 5 months, and he's incredibly busy with all the nonsense going on in South Africa and standing up for civil rights there. So, folks, what I want to do now is welcome my guest today, my special feature guest, the day before the U.S. election, the one, the only, Ernst, you're on the screen. Welcome.
Hello, Chris. Thank you. It's great to be on the show, finally. And I'm sorry that it took some effort to arrange this interview, but I have been following your show, and I'm grateful to be part of it.
Excellent. Well, don't sweat that. No, I just give me a hard time. I'm also, you're in competition for Mimi Kalinda, who runs a public relations firm in South Africa. It took me 5 months to get her on as well. So I think that you got her beat by a day or two.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. So, how are you?
It's going well. I actually just returned from holiday. It was school holidays this past week. So I took some leave as well. And me and the family, my wife and the kids, we had the week off, and I've just returned. So I'll be back in action tomorrow. But I'm well rested. And I don't know if I have a tan or not, but I've been in the sun quite a bit for the last week. So it's going very well, and it's going well with the AfriForum. It's not going too well with South Africa,
no.
But that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
Absolutely. So did you do any hunting while you were on your holiday?
No, actually not. No, we went to the sea. We went to KwaZulu-Natal, to Ballito, and we spent a few days there. But as I said, we're back now. I'm at my house.
Oh, that's lovely. I appreciate that people enjoy the beach, but I'm not a beach person. I was always too skinny and too short, ribs exposed. I was always embarrassed. I got burned really badly because, unlike the EFF, who would look at me and say that I'm white, I'm actually kind of pink. And so I fried pretty badly in the sun.
Well, I actually agree with you. This is the reason why we went to the sea now, is because I've never taken my children to the sea, because I'm also more of a bushveld, savanna type person. And I always would rather go to the mountains than to the sea. So this was sort of out of the ordinary for me. My typical holiday is usually to go, you know, to some nature reserve, or to go, a few years ago, we went up on a safari trip into Africa. We drove through Botswana into Zambia. We went to the north of Zambia, then we went to Malawi, and through Zimbabwe we came back. That was a wonderful trip. So we spent a lot of time in the bush there. We went to South Luangwa, the nature reserve. We saw, actually on one hunting trip, we saw four leopards on one trip.
Wow.
And if you there where you stay, there aren't fences around the camp. So the first night we were there, the following morning, we saw the elephant footprints between our tents. And some of the people who were with us actually woke up. They said they couldn't scream at us to say, hey, the elephants are here. So they just lay awake in their tents and listen to the elephants. But that's the perfect type of holiday for me.
Well, I would agree. That's an awesome holiday. I would enjoy that as well. I'll tell you, that's speaking of things moving in the dark, it reminds me of when I was in the Gulf War the first time, and armored vehicles were moving at night, and some were moving out ground guides. You know, unfortunately, I had a soldier crushed to death. So when you mentioned the elephants, that's what I was thinking of, because they were moving around almost zero illumination and without a ground guide, and someone was in a sleeping bag, you can't see them, that sort of thing. But yeah, it makes me think of that. Now, what you just discussed there, you talk about that an awesome trip. It sounds like the best job in Southern Africa, which most people don't know. It's actually the defense advisor or defense attaché from Canada, because the Canadian attaché in Pretoria is accredited to 14 countries in Southern Africa. So like three times during their tour, they get to travel all over Southern Africa and they hit all these game parks and everything. It's the best job in Southern Africa.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds incredible.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get right into the meat of things here. Audience is building here. We've given people a chance to show up on a tardy basis. So you are the deputy CEO of AfriForum, which is a civil rights organization based in South Africa, correct?
Yes, sort of correct. Actually, we changed the titles. We don't have deputy CEOs at AfriForum anymore. We changed to what we call a functional structure. Mm-hmm. So instead of just saying deputy CEO, your job title actually describes what you are doing. So although I still have the same position, my official title is now head of policy and action, which means that what falls under me, or what I'm in charge of or responsible for in AfriForum, is communications and our campaigns, particularly our national campaigns, international campaigns as well. And then I'm also CEO of Forum Films, which is a company owned by AfriForum. It's a film production company that makes a wide variety of multimedia films. Some of the viewers might have seen Tainted Heroes and Disrupted Land are two of the longer format documentaries that we filmed. And in terms of AfriForum, it's a civil rights organization. We were founded in 2006, and we don't get any funding from or corporations or anything like that. The only funding we get is from our members. So to be a member, you have to make a monthly contribution. You can decide how much you want. And we are the largest in the largest civil rights group on the African continent. And we did a study to find out if there are bigger civil rights groups in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia, New Zealand, South America and so forth. And we couldn't find any. So we're convinced that we're the largest civil rights group in the Southern Hemisphere as well. And we currently have just over 260,000 members, and of course their families as well, who make contributions to our work.
No, that's what I was going to ask you. So okay, if I understand correctly, you've changed to functional titles. So that title of deputy CEO is still out there. Listen, my CV will be in the email. Just check that, okay?
Okay. Well, you can apply, but the position doesn't exist anymore.
Well, there you go. So then I can complain that they didn't give me any love.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you for correcting. That's important. I didn't realize the structure changed a little bit there. So, I'm going to open this topic now. We're not going to talk about it now, but we'll talk about it after we talk about AfriForum. Just to give you context here. So, of course, I think you know well that I'm a retired military officer. I've been all over Africa, stationed all over the continent, including in Southern Africa. I've been to South Africa hundreds of times. But the first time I heard of AfriForum was by the press, the lamestream, as I like to call them, or fake stream media, who reported on it and said it was extreme right-wing nationalist group like the Afrikaner Widerstandsbewegung or something like that. And I was like, really? I thought those guys were all gone. What's this all about? And so I started looking, and I looked up for you guys. I read about it, and I'm like, I don't get what this is all about. So we don't want to go into that now. I want to go into it later. But just that was my introduction to AfriForum. It was the first time I heard about it. I was like, okay. That's strange. And obviously that's not the case. And we could talk more about that as we go on. But there's so much to unpack today and talk to you about, Ernst. For instance, I mean, you guys are pursuing this case against Andile Bonehead. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce his last name. I call him Andile Bonehead. But and then, of course, we've got Senecal 1, Senecal 2. We've got the rash of the 7 murders in October. It's unbelievable. The number of attacks are up. The brutality of these things is not diminishing at all. We see, all over the country, especially in KZN, lots of murders. We see the Indian lady who was 26 years old, 4 months pregnant. Take her out of the room with her 4 and 8 year old son, take her to the bathroom, and then cut her throat and leave her to die. And Edward Neumeister, an Austrian immigrant who's been in South Africa for nearly 50 years, is beaten with a panga so badly that his daughter can't even recognize him. Yet he's mortally wounded, yet at the age of 67 has the strength to go in and disrupt this clown as he's attacking his partner, and she's able to escape. And all this nonsense about these are about theft, but there was nothing stolen from Edward Neumeister, and there's nothing stolen from many of these places. There are thefts, but usually it's just the vehicle so they can get away. The Brandt family in the Northern Cape, 83-year-old father, 73-year-old mother. I mean, these are all just recent cases, and I haven't even talked about the ones in Mpumalanga that just happened. And, of course, Brendan Horner, which finally got some attention from outside of South Africa. This must be a terribly distressing function to be looking at these farm murders and trying to combat this without the government's help.
Yes, it is very distressing, and it's something that not only we at AfriForum, I think people who are concerned about South Africa are very concerned about, and with good reason. But what makes it worse for us is And I think that's part of the reason why people are so angry and why people were so angry. You spoke about Senekal, and people talk about Senekal 1 and Senekal 2. It's because there were these two events in the town of Senekal. What happened at Senekal 1, there were some not only commentators, police, generals, and politicians, members of the ruling party, who said they do not understand why the people are so angry, because the perpetrators have been arrested already, or the accused at least, and they are being trialed. So why are the people so angry if the people have been caught? And if you to say that is simply to indicate that you have no idea about the extent of the frustration among minorities in this country and among people who aren't left-wing in this country, and among Afrikaners, I think, in particular. Because what's more concerning than simply the murders, look, the murders are horrible. Gang-related murders are also horrible in South Africa. But what's more concerning about farm murders is the fact that it's a crime phenomenon that is being romanticized by the ruling party. We've said this many times in terms of the songs they sing, in terms of the political speeches they make. I've never heard a politician in South Africa or anywhere in the world sing about killing rhinos, or sing about beating up women and children, or singing about gang-related, being a member of one gang and murdering people who aren't a supporter of your gang, or whatever, or romanticizing copper cable theft. I mean, the list goes on. But when it comes to farm attacks, that's the reality. Is people keep singing these songs, but it's not only the songs; it's the speeches. It's the speeches in which white farmers in particular are continuously labeled land thieves and criminals. Julius Malema, when he was still president of the ANC Youth League, made a speech at a political rally in front of the state president when he said, all white people are criminals and they should be treated as such. He said that in front of the state president at a political rally. The president didn't even blink an eye. So that's why people are so concerned about this. But then on top of that, you have to combine that with all the other discriminatory realities in South Africa, which includes comments, the comment by President Cyril Ramaphosa that the ANC said that in the early 90s, that the ANC intends to deal with white people like boiling a frog alive. In other words, you raise the temperature slowly. And we have black empowerment, these racial, we have more than, there was a study done by James Myberg from Politics Web, who found more than 84 laws and policies that discriminate against minorities on a racial basis in South Africa. And the list goes on. So that's why people are so angry, because they are continuously treated like second-class citizens. And the South African government, the ruling party, simply do not care. As a matter of fact, it would be inaccurate to say they do not care, because it's something that they actively encourage. And that's the problem that we are facing.
No, absolutely. And it's I remember the hearing that the police brigadier completely detached from reality after 26 years, but especially after the last two decades. The last 20 years have been especially horrific. And listening to him say, I don't understand what they are upset about, almost like saying those people, that kind of the bigotry and racism comes in with that phrase. But he's like, he almost said those people. But he said, I don't understand what they are upset about. We caught the perpetrators. We're upset because a 21-year-old man who was born after apartheid was over was not even a farm owner. He was a farm manager, and he was murdered. And he wasn't just murdered. He was tortured brutally. Why? And why are you happy that you caught the perpetrators? Because as we see now, one of them has bail. One of them had two charges against him previously, two convictions. One had 16 convictions against him. Why are these people not in prison? Why are they walking the streets of South Africa? And it beggars the imagination that a police official, no, it doesn't, because I know the context of South Africa, but I mean, now we're seeing this nonsense here in the States. But in the normal circumstances, one would just be like, I just be gobsmacked that a police official would think that. When, for instance, yesterday, Chris Van Heerden, the former IBO welterweight champion of the world from South Africa, was on my program, and we talked about his father being murdered. And the murderer claimed self-defense, even though he shot his father in the back. I don't know how you self-defend, when you're shooting someone in the back. But he's out on $300 bail. Andre Pinar, who probably said some things he shouldn't have said, is charged with terrorism and with attempting to murder a police officer whom he slapped. I don't know how you kill somebody by slapping them. That's pretty impressive. But Andre Pinar, in the Senate call the first time, seven police cars show up to arrest him. He's denied bail. First off, they do it on a Friday, so he can't get a hearing. He's kept over the weekend, remanded. Then he's denied bail. Then eventually gets bail on a second appeal. But he's get 15,000 rand bail, which is not a lot of money, but 15,000 ban rail for essentially slapping a police officer and, you know, saying some rash things, which, you know, it's probably a legitimate charge, but I'm not going to get into that. But in the meantime, the person who is accused of torturing, stabbing multiple times, beating, tying Brendan Horner to a post and hanging him there. And I don't want to hear the nonsense from people. He wasn't hung. He was hung. His body slipped down. That person got bail of 5,000 rand. This makes no sense whatsoever.
It doesn't make sense. And that's the problem. And then we have the brigadier saying he doesn't understand why people are angry because the perpetrators have been caught. Now, imagine if, I mean, the ANC, of course, they even started this anti-racism campaign after the death of George Floyd in the USA. Imagine if someone, or imagine them saying, why are the people are so angry about George Floyd? Because the people who were involved there have already been caught. And that goes to the double standards that we see in South Africa. There's a certain threshold that count for one section of society, and there's a different one that counts for a different section. And it's not even a secret. It's something that they publicly speak about. President Jacob Zuma, of the former state president, when he was president, he spoke in parliament, and he said his exact words were, "We have more rights because we are the majority. You have less rights because you are the minority." Absolutely, that is how democracy works. And now people, you know, some people in the media immediately rushed to his defense and said, no, he didn't mean it that way. He actually meant something different. And we shouldn't, that's not necessarily the ruling party's view. But you can compare that to other comments by other senior members of the ruling party who say the same thing. Paolo Jordan has always been regarded as one of the intellectual leaders of the ruling party, especially the sort of the previous generation in the early 90s. During the negotiation for a new South Africa, he said that he recognizes, or the ANC recognizes, that self-determination for minorities and minority rights are important, and it's something that should be respected and recognized. But it's not something that the ANC will recognize, because for them, minority rights is simply a continuation of apartheid. So that's what Paolo Jordan said. And even more recently, Zizi Kodwa, who at the time was spokesperson for the ANC, I believe he's currently spokesperson for President Ramaphosa, although, you know, because of CADA deployment, they change so frequently. But recently, more recently at least, there was a riot in Eldorado Park near Johannesburg with a colored community or a mixed race community, I think, as they are called, or biracial, you know, whatever term you want to use, who were frustrated about some issues at a school, and you know, they were burning stuff and setting things on fire out of outrage. And then the spokesperson came and said, it's important that this community should not feel as if they have been reduced to the status of a minority group. So what is he actually saying by that? He's saying that minority groups have a reduced status.
This
community, who are at least half black, according to their, you know, line of reasoning, shouldn't feel as if they've been reduced to this status of a minority group. That's the problem in South Africa. And that's the frustration. And that's the frustration that was expressed at Senecal. So Afroforum's position is, we don't encourage mob justice. We don't encourage people taking the law into their own hands. But you cannot simply say, we do not understand why the people are so angry, if you do not look at the bigger picture.
Well, not encouraging violence, that's a stark contrast to the political party, actually the domestic terrorist group masquerading as a political party known as the Economic Freedom Fighters. We'll talk about that in a moment, but I need to address something in the chat here very quickly, Ernst. Anna said that he was not tortured, it was not about race, you ignore what the farmer said. I didn't ignore what any farmer said. You're the one introducing race. I don't recall mentioning that Brendan Horner was a white guy and that's why he was murdered. You've introduced race in the conversation, not me. And then Anna also said that person, 2,000 Rand paid, he has nothing. 5,000 is more than 15,000 for middle-class white person. Well, I submit to you, Anna, that that's racist and bigoted. to make the assumption that white people have money when plenty of white people don't. I grew up without electricity, without plumbing, fetch water from a cistern, used an outdoor privy, which we call an outhouse here in the States. To make the assumption that because of some skin pigmentation they have resources is just unjust. And it really isn't about that. That's a moral equivalency. That's something that a leftist would do. You'd fit right in here in the States, Anna. Right here in the States, you'd be perfect with the Black Lives Matter and Antifa, the domestic terrorist organization, doing this moral equivalency. It doesn't matter what someone has for resources. It matters the gravity of the crime. The gravity of the crime is what bail should be set upon. Then the secondary condition should be whether someone is able to pay based on whether it's a less severe crime. But I'm sorry, that moral equivalency doesn't fly here on Chris White Africa. But thank you for contributing, and you're welcome to stay and enjoy the rest of the conversation. Sorry, Ernst, I felt it was necessary to address that. I didn't raise race. This person did. And I didn't raise this false equivalency about, well, you know, Andre Pinard can afford it, the other guy can't. Well, while we're at it, Andre Pinard is a convicted criminal. He served 3 years in jail. Is that relevant? Nope, not germane either. Anyway, moving right along, Ernst.
Well, maybe to add to that, I had an interview with a journalist from the Sunday Times who called me after what happened at Senegal. And, you know, he was furious about, you know, these, you know, racist white people and whatever, and how angry they were. And it's not justifiable. And then he asked me a question that I don't think he realized how silly the question actually was. He asked me, what kind of a person thinks that you can make a political point by overturning a police vehicle? And of course, he was referring to the white people at Senegal. And I said to him, the kind of person who votes ANC believes that you make a political point by overturning a vehicle or setting something on fire. And the problem that we have in this country is that type of behavior is and has been rewarded for years. If someone feels that they don't get their point across, what they do is they burn down a school, or they burn down a library, or they set a vehicle on fire, or they throw stones through a school's classroom windows or a university or whatever. And then suddenly they get all the attention they want, and they get they get what they want. That's the reality in South Africa. It's what's happening on universities. It's what's happening on a national level. It started probably with this fees must fall and roads must fall campaigns, where the people started. It started with some guy defecating on the statue of Cecil John Rhodes at the university that was built by the money left by Cecil John Rhodes. And I'm not a Cecil John Rhodes fan at all, but this is a university built by Cecil John Rhodes, and then people were, you know, demanding the statue to be taken down because they said they can't breathe if there's the statue of him. And that type of behavior is rewarded. And I remember after that, then this riot, this national movement started, where people started burning statues and setting it on fire. And we've seen it in the USA as well. And they get their cues from the USA, of course. And then there was this meeting hosted by the Department of Arts and Culture about heritage in South Africa, and the members of this movement who actively encouraged murder. They would make speeches about murdering white people and things like that. There was a meeting hosted by the Department of Arts and Culture, and they saw these members of this movement there, and they asked them to stand up so that everyone can applaud them. And I mean, we've seen this movie over and over in South Africa. But to get back to this interview I had with the Sunday Times, and so I pointed out to this journalist, it's a term that was coined actually by a speechwriter of George W. Bush, and it was first used by the soft bigotry of low expectations. And I asked him if he recognizes that what he's doing currently is an expression of anti-Black racism. And he asked me, why am I saying this? And I said to him, because what he's saying is that if in South Africa, if we have the EFF or some movement like that rioting and vandalizing stores, it's just regarded as, you know, that's just how these people act. That's the perception in South Africa. But when it's white people, then it's condemned. Then we have the Department of Justice, the Department of Agriculture, the provincial department, the ruling party, all issuing press statements. We have the state president condemning it. So when it's white people doing this type of things, it's condemned universally. But when it's black people, it isn't. And that's an expression of anti-black racism, because what you are effectively saying is that you have a low standard for black people and you have a high standard for white people. And if black people don't comply, but it's easy for black people to comply to your standard because it's very low. But white people, you know, we should measure them by a different standard. And that's just plain racism. And it's something that shouldn't be tolerated, but it's what we see all the time in South Africa.
No, absolutely. This is not to feel your pain or anything, but just to see how stupid things get. Here in the United States, I've listened for years that it's not right. I have no role models. There's no black people on television. And my entire life, I grew up with one television show that was overwhelmingly black cast after another, one after another. But to hear that story, so just anecdotal here, I live in an area that's just by happenstance happens to be over 90% white in this county and in a state that's overwhelmingly white. But my television channels, when I turn them on, 75 to 90% of all the people appearing in all the television commercials now are people of color. Mostly black, some mixed race, a few Asians here and there, but there's no Asians within 50 miles of where I live, although we have lots of Asians in America. So this nonsense about that. But the thing that always disturbed me about that is that when I was a young man, I was inspired by Martin Luther King. I looked up to him. He doesn't look like me. I mean, I guess I'm not allowed to do that. I think you get the fallacy of the logic that they come up with here. It's just crazy with people who play these race games back and forth. So there's been a few comments in the comment section there, but I want to get to a couple other things. So you were talking about Black Lives Matter, and a lot of this is virtue signaling and empty nonsense. We saw, for instance, as you mentioned, the ANC came out with this. Every Friday is Black Lives, or Black Friday now for Black Lives Matter. They tried that after the lockdown started. Of course, that was after the security services, both SAPS and SANDF, killed 11 or 12 black South Africans in the townships. And then, of course, they started getting a lot of bad press, so they pulled away from that, and it pretty much let the townships run crazy. But it's just empty virtue signaling. I'm sure you see this every day, this silly virtue signaling.
I seem to have lost you for a second. Just repeat the question. I lost the last part of it.
No, that's all right. Your connection's a little rough.
I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, I can hear you now. I was just saying that the ANC started this virtue signaling after killing about 11 or 12 black South Africans in the townships with the security services in the overly zealous lockdown when it started back in late March, early April. So they pulled out of the townships and just let people do what they wanted to do because they didn't want the bad press. And then they started this virtue signaling. Every Friday is Black Friday. That didn't last very long. And it was at the height of hypocrisy to say that Black Lives Matter when the security services in South Africa are murdering black South African. Anyway, no, I was just talking about the hypocrisy of the virtue signaling, the empty virtue signaling that the ANC has been doing. And they do it all the time. And just to add to that, now that you're back, we've got you. I find it ludicrous. You know, you have the head of the state. You talk about the ANC senior figures. I mean, just a few weeks back, the president of South Africa was talking about the nature of white people is that they're racist. And this is why we have gender-based violence. That was his response to gender-based violence in South Africa, that white people are racist. So I think that small white toddlers running around are responsible for other South African men raping and murdering their partners and spouses.
I can hear you. Sorry about that. I don't know what's wrong with that. I'm supposed to have a proper connection, but for some reason we're having...
Well, I'm sure it's the red ants. They're probably outside digging up your cable connection as we speak.
probably. wonderful. I can see you as well. Now, what I was saying is President Ramaphosa seems to have more to say about than Colin Skoza, who was killed in South Africa by security forces during this state of disaster economic lockdown. And it's because it suits their ideological and political narrative, and it doesn't suit their narrative to talk about black people who they killed themselves. And that's the problem. That's again, it goes to the double standards. But I think it's to call it double standards is also not to really, because it's not simply a government that's trying its best, but incidentally, it also has double standards. It's a nationalist socialist movement. That's how they describe themselves. That has a very clear ideological, and you can add to that cultural agenda. And what I mean by cultural agenda is, or you can call it an ethnic agenda. They have a particular agenda with regard to black people, particular agenda with regard to white people. And they have this ideological agenda about pushing for what they call the National Democratic Revolution, which basically means that you have to use democracy to promote or to enable or push for a socialist revolution, to make the country a socialist state through democracy and through so-called democratic institutions. And for them, it's not about, for them, it's action about discriminating against minorities. It's the same way. I mean, we've seen it in many examples in the world. It's not about democracy. These people aren't Democrats. They aren't liberals. They aren't conservatives. They are outspoken socialists who believe people like Robert Mugabe, people like Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, people like Joseph Stalin and Vladimir Lenin. They believe that these people are heroes. Not only and I'm not speculating. They say this. They say that they regard these people as heroes. They even went as far as trying to rename one of the main streets in Pretoria after Mao Zedong. And when they were questioned about that, when one of the opposition parties said to them, "Do you know who Mao Zedong was? Do you know what Mao Zedong did?" They said, "Yes, but we must remember he was never found guilty of any crime." So the fact that he wasn't, I mean, he was the dictator. Of course, he wasn't found guilty of any crime. And then
20 million people killed during the Cultural Revolution, executed.
Yes, yes. And he had that, what was the name of the campaign? I think 100 Flowers Blooming campaign or something, where you could write to the government, to the Socialist Party, and you could criticize them. You could make suggestions on how the Chinese government or the Communist Party could govern better. And people were encouraged to write to them. And then what they did was they took all the people who criticized the government and they went out and they killed them. That's just one example of what Mao did. I mean, not to say tens of thousands of people were killed is an understatement. To say hundreds of thousands were killed is an understatement. And then the ANC said no, but he was never found guilty of anything. So we can venerate him. We can name a street after him. And they then said something that I think is even more significant. They said, "We as the ANC have Mao Zedong to thank for the good relationship that the ruling party, the ANC in South Africa, currently still has with the Communist Party of China." And I think that's a very significant, very important statement. And it's something that we should remind people of. But I mean, I can also add that fortunately, they didn't push through with that. I think they underestimated the backlash that they would get for naming a street after Mao Zedong. But there are many other examples. There was this idea to change the two streets in which the US embassy is based in Pretoria. It's between Pretoria's and Schoeman streets. That's what they were named before they were changed.
Well, one's already changed. Schoeman is now Francis Bard, has been for several years.
Yes, that's it. Yes. But they actually wanted to change the street to Fidel Castro Street. So they wanted to change the street in which the U.S. embassy is based to rename it after Fidel Castro. And that's the type of things. I mean, we've had Cyril Ramaphosa go into Washington and during in Washington, D.C., endorse Chinese policies, endorsing Huawei, for example. We've had them say, you know, this whole thing about Huawei and 5G, it's just, the USA is just jealous of China. That's why they're so, you know, concerned about what China's doing with Huawei. We have these type of comments, and I think people shouldn't think that the ruling party in South Africa is a democratic government that has the interest of the people at heart. Again, this isn't speculating. You can simply go out and read their policy documents. You can read what they publish on their own websites. You can listen to their speeches. You can read their press statements, and you wouldn't do a lot of reading before you find out who and what this movement really is.
No, absolutely. You know, it's comical, and knowing a little something about Huawei and what's going on there, trust me, I'm sure you know the answer. It's not jealousy. Huawei stole industrial secrets from Ericsson, from Nokia, from the United States, and that's how they're able to field a 5G network in the first place. And then they've contoured it for their needs. So not jealous. We have our own 5G networks. It's funny how the world's not talking about anyone else. All they're talking about is Huawei, as if they're the only ones to field 5G or the first. They're not. We have 5G networks here in the States now and have had for a year. But no one's talking about that because the focus on China. It's very interesting how inept country like that can win the strategic communications battle. Since you're communications, I think you'd appreciate that. China is winning the strategic communications battle. And I don't see how, because they're not very adept at it. I think it's by default. You know, it's amazing. America is the country that invented the satellite news systems, 24-hour news, cable systems, Hollywood, the movie industry, television. It all came from America. And our government is abysmal at strategic communications. I do a better job. I'm not boasting, but I do a better job communicating what our national interests are than Washington does. And that's just sad.
I would like to add to that because I agree with you. And I've said this to people in Washington earlier this year. I mean, we're there to garner support, but in some cases, people ask us for our opinion and we give them our opinion. And especially talking about China and Washington. And I think the single most important thing in terms of what China and what the US is doing differently, and I think why China is at least to a certain extent winning, is China has a coherent message that is communicated frequently and consistently. And it's hard if you're not in the US or if you are in the US as well to really flesh out what is the US's position on China and what is the US's position on some of these issues. And I think that's as Afrikaners, we regard ourselves as Africans and but also as Westerners, and people, especially Afrikaners, but a lot of people in South Africa look to the USA, you know, as the leader of the free world and all of that. But I think there's some criticism to the establishment in Washington. If you ask my opinion on that, I'll tell you. And I think it's that I don't see a coherent message. I think there's too much disagreements and debating, and you don't really get a consistent message coming from Washington about China and about what's happening in the world at the moment. And I'm not talking about the White House. I'm talking about because I think Trump has a strong message, but if you look at the establishment, you hear people speaking in opposites, and I it's a concern, and I think it's something that the US should focus on.
Well, I agree absolutely. It's having lived it, you know, I worked in 8 embassies in Africa, and it's one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing at times, and then sometimes it's the deep state desires. It's why I found comical. Some Liberian American was granted ink in the New York Times within 3 months of Trump taking office. And she wrote this fictitious fairy tale about how Trump has cut foreign assistance in half by 60% or something like that. I'm like, what are you talking about? The budget is a matter of law. He can't cut anything. He's been president for 90 days. This budget continues for this year. Nothing's been done. And I wrote a rebuttal to New York Times, and of course they didn't bother to carry it. But that's just crazy stuff. Let me take care of a couple super chats here real quick, Ernst, and then
and then
Caesar has like 37,000 questions. So I'm not going to get to all your questions, Caesar, but we'll get to a couple of them. So Flying Boar, who's an Indian in Canada, says Ernst came to America 2 years ago, appeared on Fox News. Yep, saw you on Tucker Carlson. Did he get to meet White House officials or Congress? You did meet some people. I think you met a couple senators. I don't know. Are you able to share, not necessarily who you met with, but the level of officials you met with on that trip?
Yes, we met with a variety of people, people in the House and the Senate, who are especially, we focus especially on people who are members of the Foreign Affairs Committees, but not exclusively. So we've spoken with quite a few people, and sometimes you don't get to the actual senator, but you get to the chief of staff or something like that. And we also speak with Republicans and Democrats. So we spoke with them. We've spoken with many think tanks, and I think people who aren't in the US or who don't follow American politics can easily underestimate the role that think tanks play, because it's sort of a foreign concept to people in South Africa. We have some think tanks in South Africa. We have the IRR and we have the Free Market Foundation and the Center for Development of Enterprise and so forth. But think tanks are very influential in the US, especially in terms of advising senators and Congress people and so forth. So we spoke with a bunch of them and obviously people in the media. And we spoke with not the White House, but with the State Department. We've had a few meetings actually with the State Department, meetings that I would regard as successful meetings. We met with John Bolton, and that caused quite an uproar in South Africa. And we've been you know, honest about that from the start. We didn't have a meeting with him, so we literally bumped into him in the green room at Fox News, and we were waiting for my interview, and John Bolton was waiting for a different interview. So we walked up to him and said, "Hey, we'd like to introduce ourselves. We're from AfriForum. We know who you are." And we gave him a copy of my book, Kill the Boer. And we had probably a 30 seconds conversation. And he said that he's aware of what's happening in terms of the farm murders in South Africa. And he took the book and we took a picture with him. And then, you know, that started the conspiracy theories about who did AfriForum meet with and who didn't we meet with. But we've had some very good meetings. I think especially with the State Department, as I've mentioned, and people in the House and the Senate. But there's a lot more that has to be done. We've spoken with USAID, USAID, I think as it's usually referred to, about, you know, the extent to which they are involved in South Africa. And a variety of others. So we have quite a network in Washington, but we've achieved quite a bit of success to date in terms of getting publicity to what's happening in South Africa, getting people to pay attention to the problem. But there's still a lot that has to be done. I think what we would like to achieve, and I think what the US should do or can do to help is at least to pass a motion through either the House or the Senate or both, through the Foreign Affairs Committees, at least to say we are concerned about what is happening in South Africa. And we have to monitor this and see what happens. Because South Africa is running the risk of violating the AGOA agreement. It not only running the risk, it's actually already violated.
I'm already calling for South Africa's suspension under the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. The mere introduction of an expropriation without compensation bill into the parliament is a violation, in my view. I'm not an attorney, of certainly the spirit, if not the law. Yeah, so South Africa should be suspended, and you should not be able to send your $10 billion worth of goods to the United States without duty, as of right now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, because the agreement, I mean, it's a trade agreement, and the agreement says that the parties to the agreement have to protect property rights. And it also says the parties have to, not only should there be a free market in that country, but it must increasingly, the market must increasingly promote a free market. So the market must become freer, not more restricted. So that's, I think, in a sense, you're right to say, and simply passing a motion of expropriation without compensation in Parliament is already a violation of that agreement.
Well, sorry to interrupt you there. I don't like to do my guests very often, but this is an important point, and I want to get your take on this because I don't want to forget this conversation. I have been telling people since this nonsense was introduced in 2017 or 2018 that this is not about farmland. It is about farmland, but it's not exclusively about farmland. This is a bill that will be used by the party in power of the day as a political cudgel to intimidate anyone who dares speak out against the government. Oh, you want to speak out against our party ABC? Well, guess what? We're going to take your checking accounts. We're going to take your Bucky. We're going to take your SUV, your Q7. We're going to take your retirement accounts. Oh, okay, never mind. I don't have anything to say. It will be used as a tool of intimidation, and it'll also be used to pilfer people's wealth, but it'll also be used anytime anybody says anything against the government. It will silence opposition because you'll be penniless and in prison. And that's my concern. It is about farmland, but it is about much more than that, because you already have expropriation without compensation in Article 25 of the Constitution. But, you know, if you want to take somebody's money, it doesn't work out well, because if you take 1 million rand from them, you have to compensate them. What's the compensation? 1 million rand. You can take land for, you know, what we call eminent domain here for in the interest of the state, but then you've got to compensate. So it's a little bit different. But expropriation without compensation, to me, is all about political power and tyranny. Aaron, stop. Sorry, you're just getting back there. But Flying Boris sent a cheeky super chat. He said, if the ANC wants to change the name of the street in front of the U.S. Embassy in Hatfield, then the U.S. should change the name of the street in the U.S. Embassy or the South African Embassy in D.C. and call it Hendrik Verwoerd. I don't know if we want to do that. That's probably, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty clever.
Yeah, that's clever and a bit cheeky. But I don't know. How much did you hear about my comment about expropriation?
I think I got the gist of it. And I think you're right. And it's important to state this. This is not simply about farmland. They are using farmland as an argument. But what they are doing, you can read the motion. It doesn't say expropriate farms or farmland. It says expropriate property.
Property.
Expropriate private property. So at the moment, there's no talk in South Africa about expropriating people's cars and laptops and things like that. But I think what people need to understand, it's that old metaphor Winston Churchill spoke about feeding the crocodile. The plan or the strategy isn't just to bash the door open and just to grab everything they want. It's a gradual thing. That's why they call it a national democratic revolution. So it's a gradual thing to change the constitution, to change the property rights clause, to say, listen, you don't need to worry. We're going to do this very responsibly. We're not going to do the same thing that happened in Zimbabwe. There are going to be some checks and balances in place, and there's going to be some prerequisites or requirements or conditions under which we're going to do this. But the state must have the power to expropriate people's private property without compensation, in principle. And then a lot of people fall for this. They, especially, you know, commentators in the media, they say, why are you so angry? Because they've said that they're going to do this responsibly. They said that they are going to do this in a way that would boost the economy, not hurt the economy. And we always joke about that. We say that's like saying that we're going to aggressively expand KFC, but no chickens are going to be harmed in the process. So that's the reality. Is it's not simply about farmland. It's about property, and it's not only about property. It's about an openly Marxist-Leninist movement that boasts about their Marxist roots and their Marxist philosophies and ideology, that has a problem with all forms of inequality. They want to entrench or enforce equality of outcome. In other words, everyone must reach the finishing line at the same moment, regardless of how fast you are, regardless of whether you prepared for the race, regardless of any other factor, regardless of whether you actually prepared or whether you're a hard worker or you aren't. We must all reach the finishing line at the end of the day. And it's this typical communist utopia, this thing that I can't remember if it was Marx or Lenin. I think it was Marx who wrote about people sitting under the tree next to the river one day when this utopia has arrived. And they use this terminology. President Cyril Ramaphosa himself said that, and he linked it to expropriation of private property without compensation, when he said that it's going to, the ANC is going to create the Garden of Eden in South Africa through expropriation of private property without compensation. And he said, we can create the ultimate paradise. Those were his words. In South Africa, by taking people's stuff, and that's how detached they are from reality. And I think that's the concern here. And I mean, we can talk about how detached they really are from reality. One of the worst examples, I mentioned this in an interview the other day as well, was the ambassador to Venezuela, who said about, I believe it was last year, who said that. During a speech in Venezuela, of course, he was supporting Maduro and the Venezuelan government. And he said the South African government, he railed against the USA. He then said the South African government is prepared to take up arms and send soldiers to fight the USA. I mean, how detached from reality do you have to be to think that with the South African army as it is, the South African Defense Force, you can not only declare war against the USA, but actually send your troops to the USA to fight them over there. That's how detached they are from reality. Well, and it's very funny, but it's also very sad.
Well, it wouldn't be any trouble at all. I mean, they simply board SAA flights and come to Miami. So, wait, there is no South African Airways. It's in business rescue, the euphemism for bankruptcy. Again, yes. A couple points real quick to talk about how it, obviously I'm not going to deny there are a whole passel load of racists in the economic freedom fighters, and increasingly more and more racists making their face shown in the African National Congress, which is really sad, really sad. But I'm not saying all the people in the ANC are, certainly not, but there are enough of them. But there's two things that make this pretty clear that this is, you know, it's more than race, it's about control and power. And number one is that, first off, the department responsible for lands has been habitually underfunded by the ANC while they pilfered money from the arms deal that was supposed to be $4.6 billion US dollars, wound up being $7.1 billion. What are those Gripens doing now, sitting on the ground being flown by contract pilots? What are those Hawk lead and fighter trainers doing, those Type 209 diesel submarines? Why in God's name did South Africa need diesel submarines to protect them against Botswana in the Okavango? Is that what they're for? Or cruisers? And so all that money. And what about Nkandla and Oilgate and Travelgate? And we could just go on and on and on. State capture, the theft, the trillions of rand now that have probably been pilfered from South Africa's economy. Where has it gone? Money that could have been used to resolve the few legitimately remaining land cases from the original window, which is 1995 to 99, when 75,000 cases were filed for restitution. 74,000 have been resolved. There's about 1,000 left. And then the fraudulent window, which Jacob Zuma opened up, which opened a can of worms of 141,000 additional land claims, most of which are fraudulent, and it's really clogging the system up. But the government has never taken the issue of land seriously. It's just, it's a red herring. They have thousands of hectares in their hands. They provide no credit, no extension services, no advice for new farmers, nothing. It's all red herring. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, I don't know if you saw this, Aaron, but I don't know if you're a netball follower. I find it amusing. It's not really a sport I enjoy, but the Mpumalanga Sunbirds won the other day, 43-42 against the Queens. And congratulations to the, no, they lost the game because they violated transformation rules. Yeah. So the Telecom Netball League requires that they have a balance of players, white and black, on the team. And so what happened was, I'm sure a lot of people like, oh, here we go again. I'm sick of this. Springboks, too many white players. Nah, you're wrong. Too many black players were playing on the team. So for one little period, in one little spot in the second period, they had six black players on the court and just one white player. And so for that, they had 43 points taken away from them. They forfeited the division semifinal and didn't go to the final. Now that matters because the white and black players on that netball team are competing for attention for professional leagues in Australia and in the United Kingdom so they can have a career and make money and do something as a professional athlete. So now a team that didn't win advances and these other players don't get any attention over the idiocy of this transformation. So that's not a, you know, this is a case where technically whites were discriminated against because not enough white girls were on the court. How stupid is this? I mean, this is the world that you all live in. It must drive you insane.
Yeah, it's crazy, and it just goes on and on. I know Solidarity, the trade union of that's affiliated to AfriForum, have been in many court cases involved with black empowerment and affirmative action. At least they call it black empowerment. It's rather a policy of black dependency because it makes black people dependent on the South African government. But they've had these crazy cases where I remember one case where an Indian, they couldn't make an appointment because according to the policy, they only had room for half an Indian, and they couldn't find half an Indian to appoint. And there was another case where they had to explain why this position is left vacant. And then they had this immensely complicated calculation with mathematical equations in terms of how the racial composition should be. And there's if you count the amount of positions that are available, and if you look at the demographics, it means that there's only room for 0.2% people of this race and so forth. And then they just leave it vacant because they don't know who to appoint. But the fact of the matter is, with that netball team, it shouldn't be a problem if the entire team is black, if those people are there on merit. If the best players are black, they should be on the team. And that's part of the double standards in South Africa. There's been many cases in South Africa where Bafana Bafana, where the soccer team was completely black, and it wasn't an issue. It was 100% black team, and people supported them because they were the best players. But now we have this whole issue, of course, with the Springbok team all the time. And sometimes it's not an issue if all the players are black, and then they would defend it. They would say, no, because of the history of discrimination, if the entire team is black, it doesn't matter. So there's only a threshold for white people, not for black people. And then sometimes, as we had now with this netball incident, it's a problem. So they don't even know how to apply their own policies. And it just goes to how ludicrous the situation is. And what makes it even more crazy is the Population Registration Act of 1952 or something was repealed because it's said to be, it's racist. Because the Population Act literally was the piece of legislation in South Africa that was used to categorize people according to their skin. So it said on your ID document or your passport or whatever, it said you are a white person or you are black or you are Indian or whatever. And then the new government came and they said, that's racist, we can't do that. So they repealed that act, but they still keep applying it. So legally in South Africa, there's no law in South Africa that categorizes you. So if someone says to me, I'm white, I can legally challenge them on that and say, according to what definition do you define me as white? According to what law? And now we have laws that discriminate against people based on the color of their skin, but we don't have laws that define the different races or that categorizes people according to the color of their skin, because everyone agrees that that's racist. So it's this crazy situation that we have in South Africa. And this goes back to, and it's an important constitutional legal point, of de facto versus de jure. De jure, it's crazy. I mean, and what I mean is, just looking at the legislation, it doesn't make sense. But the de facto reality, in other words, what's happening in real life, it just doesn't care about whether the laws are stupid or whether the laws make sense or not, because they just steamroller their ideas over that. And that just says that de facto reality, there's an important political lesson to be learned from that, and that is that de facto carries more weight than de jure. What happens in real life carries more weight than whether the law makes sense or not.
Crazy. We're coming up in just about an hour here, folks. Ernst, we've had some connection troubles and lost a little bit of time with you. I don't know if you're able to stay longer, if you have to cut out, but if you can stay a little bit longer, I can get a few chat questions in, and we haven't even addressed case. Okay, great. So we'll get a few questions in here from the chat. Caesar, don't worry. I've seen all your questions. I've got about six of them stacked up. We're going to get to one or two. Sorry, not all of them. And I know you've asked more than six. I want to get to the case that you guys, you're appearing in court tomorrow, I believe. We'll get that in a moment. But let me go ahead and get to some of the stuff from Caesar. And also, Yanni Meyer had a question earlier. So Caesar asked the question, where's this one at? So AfriForum's mission to secure the Afrikaner's existence has sought international support. Have you sought international support? Has the Kingdom of the Netherlands been petitioned on behalf of the vulnerable Afrikaners? I don't know that the basis of that question is correct. Is AfriForum's mission to secure Afrikaner's existence? I think your purpose is minority rights. And if I'm wrong, please correct me. You have sought international support. You've traveled around the world, including the U.S. and other places. And I'm not sure why people would turn to the Netherlands, because I think that's based on a fallacy that Afrikaners are Dutch, when actually that's the second largest percentage of your DNA. It's actually more German than Dutch. But anyway, so can you unpack that and answer that in any way?
Yes. So we have good relations with people in different governments and countries across the world. And we have good relations with especially some politicians in the Netherlands from different parties who are sympathetic to our cause. And we've had this motion that was passed in the Netherlands, I believe it was last year. But there's not, if the question is whether we are petitioning them to sort of export people, you know, back in quotation marks to the Netherlands, that's not, I mean, we want to create a future in South Africa and in Africa. So we don't want people to leave. A lot of people are leaving the country and we're very sad about that. And a lot of these people have good reasons to leave. But if everyone just leaves, it also means that our culture will die. So we want the culture to survive and to thrive. And so our mission is to create a future in South Africa, or at least in the southern tip of Africa.
I just caught this here because I haven't seen him in the chat for a while. His father passed away recently. That's Johan Eisel, who is South Africa's premier illusionist. He once made the Four Trekker monument disappear. And I hear that the ANC offered a ministerial post to him the next day. Only they found out it was an illusion. The Four Trekker monument was still there, so they took it back. Anyway. But Johan says, you guys are doing a great job. Thanks for sharing that, Johan. And then let's see, along the thread you just brought out there just a moment ago. By the way, folks, you're listening to Chris White Africa on the Adab Africa channel. I'm Chris, right here in central Pennsylvania. My special feature guest on a Monday is Ernst Ritz from AfriForum, whom I gave the wrong title to earlier because he's changed his title, but he's responsible for communications there at AfriForum these days. I think he was always responsible for that. But anyway, so there was a question here, kind of a follow-up to something you opened up a moment ago about emigration. So Proudly Neanderthal asked this question. I don't know that you have the answer. I have my estimate, but how many South Africans have emigrated since ANC rule of the last 26 years? I don't know anybody has accurate figures, but I have my own estimation.
There was a study a few years ago that estimated about 500,000 have left. I don't think there's an accurate, up-to-date study about how many people have left. We know it started spiking, ironically, after President Ramaphosa became president. Everyone thought he was going to be the big hope. He's going to save the country. And then, you know, immediately after he started, we started all this talk about expropriation without compensation. And he actually turned out to be much more ideologically radical than Jacob Zuma, than his sister. So there was a spike recently. I don't think there are up to date numbers, but I do know that there was a study a few years ago that about 500,000 have left.
There's a good question here from Jacques Vint. I'm not going to get to it at the moment. I'll get to it in a second because I'm trying to do these in order here. Thanks for sharing that, Ernst. Yeah, my figure is a bit higher than that, to say the least. I think that's a gross underestimation. Just based on the number of South Africans in the United Kingdom alone exceed that, I'm pretty sure. But with Australia, New Zealand, United States thrown in other places, I think it's a lot higher. But the bottom line is this, and here's the other thing. The nature of emigration hasn't been white Afrikaans-speaking South Africans. There was a lot of people early on that was the case. But the majority of people leaving now seem to be black South Africans and coloreds. They're leaving in droves. Anywhere they can get out of, it's pretty crazy. So there's a question here from Richard Lemma. Richard said, please ask Ernst if AfriForum can do an in-depth analysis of crimes committed between all races in South Africa. Between all races, in other words, black on white, white on black, black on colored. I know that the Institute for Security Studies does a great deal of research into crime in South Africa, and Johnny Steinberg has written a lot about it in the past. Do you guys do anything about that or research it?
Yes, we have spoken about that, and I would like to do an in-depth study on that. Part of the problem with that particular issue is South Africa, for some reason, and we can speculate what the reasons are, but they do not have accurate, the South African police does not have accurate details in terms of crime in a broken down in terms of race. In the USA, you can get that information fairly easily. There's been a few studies to calculate. I think there were four different studies to do, for example, a racial breakdown in terms of murder in South Africa. But you can't get that numbers from the police. In other words, they don't. I believe they write it down in the dockets, but they don't release it. The statistics in terms of what was the percentage, what percentage of homicides, as they call it, or murders, are committed by white people as opposed to black people, as opposed to, you know, all the other racial groups, and what percentage of the victims are white as opposed to black, as opposed to all the others. We don't have that statistics in South Africa. The closest we can get are estimates or studies based on calculations based on dockets. People would study police dockets. They would take a few thousand and make a calculation. And as I said, there have been four such studies that I'm aware of, or estimates. And they reach different conclusions. But one thing that we are considering as AfriForum is to write to the police commissioner to ask for that detail to be released, because it's written down in the docket. So at least to release what information they have. And we can use the Promotion of Access to Information Act in South Africa to, if you request information from a government institution that, and you can argue, especially that it's in the public interest and they don't want to give you that information, you can use this act to force them to get a court order that the information has to be released. So we are considering that. But other than that, you have to work with the information or the studies that have been done or the estimates that have been done to date.
All right, that's great. So I'm going to get to Caesar's question, one of his questions right now. Caesar's been very patient. Thank you for your patience, Caesar, who contributes a lot on the chat here. But before I do that, hey, what's the deal here? Is it all my regular subscribers? I mean, I don't see a lot of people subscribing during this chat. If you're new to the channel, you haven't been here, okay, take a second, smash that subscription button. And that would be the extent of my Ronaldo Jose e-begging for this stream. So there you go. Ronaldo's not here, so we'll make sure he knows about that. But so Caesar asked this question. He said, and it was a bit ago now, so he said, AfriForum declares itself as a non-for-profit group. Membership has increased by over 200,000 between 2006 and 2019. What funding percentage has been allocated to counterterrorism? Before you answer that, I don't know how you're going to answer. I mean, you're not a group involved in counterterrorism fight. I mean, that's a government function. So I'm sure you may be awareness. I mean, I don't know. Is that something you're involved in?
Well, I'm not sure if he was referring to farm murders or counterterrorism in general. What I can tell you is, I think firstly, people underestimate what goes into overheads in running an organization in terms of, you know, having a building and paying salaries and paying, you know, the expenses that you have to go to make sure the systems are running, to make sure that you have a system that the database in terms of all the members' details is secure, and all of that.
Make sure you pay ESCOM.
Yes, rates and taxes, all of that. So that's probably the biggest chunk of our budget. I do not have the budget breakdown with me, But what I can tell you is that we do spend a significant amount of money on security, or not so much security, or safety initiatives. So to what we do is to establish community safety structures all over the country. We have about, the number goes up and down because if there's a structure that doesn't operate properly, we close it down. So the number goes up and down, but it's around 130 to 150 local safety security structures. In other words, it's like a neighborhood watch. It's something like old commando system, but it's privately run. Run through involvement by the local community. And through that, we have a team of full-time employees who deal with that, who manage that, who do the admin, who work with the people and so forth. But other than the employees themselves, we have about 10,000 volunteers who are involved with these community safety structures. In other words, it's people all over the country who drive patrols, who have radio contact with each other in their communities. And in many cases, we find that when people see crimes, they call the AfriForum safety security or local security structure before they call the police. And in many times when there are farm murders or farm attacks, we find that the AfriForum structure is there before the police arrives. So that is part of the reality. Private security is a real phenomenon in South Africa. We have more private security officers in South Africa than the police and the military combined. And so that's something that we do invest in heavily.
There are nearly 600,000 private security guards in South yep. Africa employed. It's the single largest sector of the economy, I think, at this point, larger than mining, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Yeah, we have about the latest numbers I saw was about 190,000 full-time police officers, people employed by the South African Police Service, which means that there's about three times as many, almost three times as many people in private security in South Africa as there are members of the police. And people from South Africa who watch this would know that if you want to be safe in South Africa, you get private security, you don't get the police.
No doubt. So Paul Sheridan asked this question, I mean, not for you, answer. Can you donate all your super chats on this stream to AfriForum? I'm sure you can afford it. I hope you don't mind me asking. Paul, I don't mind you asking at all, but I don't have a good super chat game going there. It wasn't the purpose of my channel. I grudgingly made memberships available because people wanted to be part of the community, and I don't egg people on for super chats. I'd happy to do it, but the charge to send the money to South Africa is currently more than the total super chats have come in on this. So if I were to go to MoneyGram, it would cost me more to send it than it would be for the. It's less than $20. So, but I'm happy to do it. Maybe I do it through. PayPal or something like that. We'll check into that. But anyway, so there you go. So this isn't a channel that spends a lot of time on that. Anyway, so now this Oak, I have no idea who this guy is. He's always on my channel, Ernst. I don't know. And he pretends his name is Ernst. I don't know what he goes. He goes by this username, the Conscious Caracal. I think he's trying to be clever. Yeah. He said, can you get Ernst to tell the wholesome story about the boxes for farmers in the Free State? Is this about the arson and the fires there? Is that what that's about?
Yes. Yes, it's. I saw Conscious Caracal was here. He's a colleague of mine in the chats, and he's putting me on the spot now because I was on leave this week, and he's asking me to comment on what AfriForum did during the time when I was on leave, but I did follow it through social media. I tried to rest, so I wasn't in contact with my colleague that much, but it's a very great story. So, I mean, we had these horrible fires. I don't know what the total is now. I believe it's more than 100 hectares that was burnt down, massive damage in the Free State. And a lot of people came to us and also said, listen, we want to help in some way. So we started this initiative where people can pack a box with whatever they have to send to these people for support, whether it be food, it can be clothes, it can be toys for children or anything. And they can just put it in a box and bring it to our office and we'll make sure that it gets to the people whose property was burned down, people who are really suffering as a result of this fire. And I don't know what the total amount or the total weight was, but there are some clips on and pictures on social media. And basically our office was full. There were truckloads full of boxes that people sent that eventually went to these farmers, and not only the farmers, this community. And it's a great story of a community that gets together, that sees this, and here's people who are in trouble. I don't know, I can't necessarily get in my car and drive over there to help extinguish the fires, but what I can do is I can pack a box with stuff, some of my stuff that I'm not using, or I can go and buy stuff and fill a box with whatever I can and have it sent to them. And it's just, it's part of this amazing story of how people, civil society and local communities in South Africa are helping each other and are realizing that you cannot be dependent on government. The government is the problem, not the solution. We cannot wait for government to support these people. Government isn't going to do that. If we send money to government to help these people, they're only going to steal it. I mean, that's not even a joke. That's just a reality in South Africa. So we just do it ourselves. So the Solidarity, the union started this slogan recently, Ons Alself, we will do it ourselves. And it's within that spirit to say, we're not waiting for government. We're going to do something ourselves. And it's a great story of people getting together and rolling up their sleeves and becoming involved in a way in which they can make a difference.
No, absolutely. And it's I think you're absolutely right. You can't, whether it's private security or neighborhood patrols or it's transportation, you're arranging things like that, or firefighting equipment and local fire brigades, because the government is not showing up. It doesn't maintain its equipment, if it even has equipment. It's a really, really sad situation, particularly with what happened there in Free State. Less than 48 hours after, of course, the number three in the Economic Freedom Fighters stood on the stage at Senekal and sang in Zulu, and then made sure he put this part in English. Call the fire brigade, burn the Boer, burn them out, burn them down. And less than 48 hours later, we see 247,000 acres of land in the Northern Free State or around the vicinity of Herzogville, among other places, torched, houses destroyed, tractors, farm equipment, barns, stores of grain, thousands of head of livestock, wild game, farm laborers, homes burned. It's just horrific. And of course, unfortunately, we saw Tevi Nell. I haven't heard a status on him, if he's still around, but he was horrifically burned, second and third degree burns, trying to put the fire out. A lot of people were rushing to try to help with the fire, and I tried to caution people. I said, listen, you know, if you don't have firefighting experience, it's probably appreciated what you're doing, but you're putting yourself at risk. That's a very dangerous situation, particularly with the Veld fire. Winds change and you get surrounded, and it's very dangerous. So anyway, that's awesome that AfriForum is doing that. Let me get to a couple more questions here really quick, and then I want to get to the Andile case, if you don't mind. So we don't miss that before you're out of here. So Yanni Meyer says, there was a report that AfriForum asked for talks with Ramaphosa. I don't know if that's recent, or can you elaborate on that?
Yes, it is recent. It's about a week ago. We sent a letter to President Ramaphosa, in which it was after this whole cynical thing, in which we explained what I've explained in this interview as well, that the anger about the anger that was witnessed at Brendan Horner's at the hearing, the first hearing of the accused, is not simply about the murder of Horner himself. It's that as well, but it's a bigger picture. So it's to explain this bigger picture, and the letter is public. It's on our website as well. And to say that we want to discuss this with the state president. He published a letter in which he condemned the murder, which is great, but it doesn't make any difference at all. If it doesn't result in some form of a policy change or something actually being done about farm murders, you know, the president writing a letter is pretty useless or irrelevant. So we did request a meeting with the state president, and we did receive confirmation of receipt, but we're still waiting for feedback. Usually when we write, we have a particular contact in the president's office to whom we send our letters, and we usually get a response. So I'm sure we will get a response. We'll see if the response is yes, the president will meet with you. But
all right,
I'll keep you guys posted.
Well, thanks for that. So the Conscious Kirkle said, if you're living abroad, you can support AfriForum by becoming a friend of AfriForum. Google Friends of AfriForum. Well, you can also become a member of AfriForum from abroad if you want. But the problem is they send me all the emails. Now, in full disclosure, I'm not a member of AfriForum. I've never financially supported. I just reported on it to try to stay objective. But I was curious about membership, and it's great. But the problem is they send me all the emails in Afrikaans. Marek Pratne Afrikaansni. Hey, AfriForum, ek watch out.
So that's your Ronaldo impersonation.
Oh, actually, yeah, that's a Ronaldo. That was it. I didn't realize that. That is, I guess, a Ronaldo impersonation. Yeah. So go ahead.
No, let me just elaborate on that a bit. You can, we do actually, firstly, our language of operations is Afrikaans, and We don't intend changing that because part of our mission is to create a future for Afrikaners. But our communication to our members is not exclusively in Afrikaans. We do have an English newsletter. So we have a weekly newsletter that we call the Funk Pos, and there's an English version of that as well. So if you become a member, if you prefer the English one, we can send that to you as well. It's a bit tricky to be a member of AfriForum if you live abroad, which is why we created this platform called Friends of AfriForum. So you go to friendsofafriforum.com and you can fill in the form there, and you can, through that platform, you can, for all practical purposes, become a member. But as with membership in South Africa, that means that you have to make a monthly contribution. But we would really encourage people to do that.
Great. So we're going to get to the Ondeli thing, but just let me see if there's one more here I want to get in before we get to Ondeli, because I can't keep you here all day. Where is it at? I have these questions are a little bit older now. So I asked Caesar's questions already. Oh, Jacques Vince said, do you guys really think that we'll be able to stop the ANC with legal means, people who have no regard for the law? Before you answer that, Ernst, I would say that not everyone in the ANC has no regard for the law. It's just that I've always told people anecdotally, the thing about the ANC, going back before Ramaphosa came out, I said, I've told people since 94, the thing about the ANC is about 60% of the people, this is historic, I'm not saying it's contemporary, 60% of the people in the ANC are actually dyed in the wool, committed, patriotic South Africans, many of whom believe in the multiracial society and equality and fairness, and they're okay with a market-based economy. But about 40% of the ANC have always been these dyed in the wool leftists, kill all the white people, chase all the minorities out, expropriate, nationalize everything. And I said that when the day came that the balance shifted and the scales went to 50-50, then South Africa's in trouble. And in December 2017 at the Party Congress, when Ramaphosa ran against Nkosi Sibanye-Dalamini Zuma and he won by just 70 votes, I said that we are at knife's edge now. It's 50-50, and if it tips the other direction, and I'm concerned it's gone the other way. So, but back to the question, Jacques is saying that do you guys really think that legal means will stop the ANC?
There's a great quote by Tuitius, the Afrikaans author, who said that we need to pray with the knowledge that everything depends on God, but we also need to work as if everything depends on ourselves. And I can use that quote or paraphrase that to answer the question, which is that we should use the legal means that are at our disposal as if it's going to have a massive impact. But we must also work outside of our legal strategy. I'm not saying outside of the law. I'm saying outside of our legal strategy. In other words, just organizing people and lobbying and just developing, building alternatives, building our own university, building our own media networks and so forth, as if this legal strategy is not going to work. So I can be pessimistic and say, the legal strategy is not going to work. I have my doubts. I actually did my master's degree on the South African Constitution, and the extent to which the South African Constitution does not protect minorities the way it promises to do. So I'm very skeptical about, and it's in South Africa, it's blasphemy to criticize the Constitution. But the Constitution is worthy of criticism because it sounds great if you read it in paper. But the question is, how is it implemented and how is it interpreted in practice? So there are some serious pitfalls or downfalls in the South African legal system. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't use it at all. Flip Bass always says we mustn't confuse tactics with strategy. So what we do in the courts is more a tactic than it is a strategy. We believe it would be irresponsible and it would be myopic to try to create a future for minorities in South Africa simply by using the courts. It's more a tactic. So sometimes you can get victories, you can achieve successes in the courts. The strategy is to build institutions, to build our own things, to make ourselves independent from government, to make sure that we pay as little tax as we can, if that's part of the question. To make sure that we're not dependent on government educational institutions, on whatever other institutions, government institutions, and make ourselves state-proof as much as we can and develop our own institutions through which we take care of our own community. But part of the tactic in achieving this is we always say we need to, in Afrika, at AfriForum, we have this slogan, Fach in Bau, which means fight and build. So we have to fight the bad policies. And while we're doing this, we have to develop our own alternatives. And the legal strategy is more a tactic than a strategy. And that's where the fighting comes in. The strategy is on the building side.
So I'm going to make a comment from Bram Janssen van Rensburg, who said something, and then I'm just going to get that last question, and then Andile, and then, because we can't keep you here forever. You've been very generous with your time. Okay, so not that I'm trying to chase you off, but Bram Janssen van Rensburg says, I can speak a language that Chris can't speak. Be careful, Bram. Be careful, Bram. Ik praat niet Afrikaans niet, maar ik verstaan. So yeah, so the question I want, this is from very early in the chat, and was a good question, I think, but let me make sure I get Graham, or excuse me, Gareth Newham. Hans asked a question. He said, Gareth Newham of the ISS alleged that AfriForum is creating misconceptions in media that farm attacks are terror attacks. Now, I think what Hans is saying is that Hans thinks that that he's siding with militant views, this Graham Newham. I'm not sure. Do you know about this? I've not read anything from ISS recently. So is Graham Newham claiming that you're creating misperceptions?
I'm not sure. He might have said that. I don't think I've met him, Mr. Newham, although I've read some of the stuff that he's written. I know he's a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. And based on only what I've seen through social media, which usually isn't a good indicator, I am concerned about his own bias, because I've seen him make some comments that lead me to conclude that he has a very strong political, ideological, preconceived ideas at least that color his conclusions. And I hope that I'm wrong. I've seen him comment on political things that leads me to be concerned about some of his conclusions when it comes to things such as farm attacks. But I hope that I'm wrong, and maybe one day if I meet him, I'll see that I'm wrong on that. I know he's done some great research, and I know he's a good researcher. But other than that, I don't really know. I can't comment any further just because I don't have the information.
Yeah, same here. I'm not familiar with that. I know a lot of the people at ISS, and I've met them. I've been there before, but I don't know him. In fact, people are trying to get me to get Yaki Siliers on the program. Love to have Yaki on, but I hadn't asked him, because when I write to him on LinkedIn or I post on his things, he never really responds. So I think it's just one direction. He's not like Chris back and forth. But people said someone's been in touch with Yaki, said happy to have him on the channel. So I'll have him on sometime soon. Okay, so let's shift for gears, because you've been very generous with time. Oh, by the way, the e-begging worked out there, Ants, because a few people have been subscribing now. So let me try it again. So if you're not a subscriber to Chris White After, hey, take a second. Look, a special price for you guys today, because we had Ernst in the program. I'm going to cut you a deal. Today and today only, you can subscribe to Chris White Africa for absolutely nothing. Subscription is free all day long. Go ahead and subscribe. Of course, that's every day on YouTube. It's membership that costs money. Anyway, so Ernst, you guys have a court case tomorrow against this buffoon. I can say that. I'm not in South Africa, and I'm not denigrating. That's not criminal injuria. By buffoon, I mean this guy is a clown. He's an absolute clown. He's a dangerous clown, and fortunately got very little support in the 2019 election. But this chap called Andile, who is for Black Lives First, Black Land First, or something like that. Can you tell us about that case and what it's all about?
Yes, so it's a continuation of the case. It's already started earlier, I think last year, about a year ago. And we couldn't finish on the days that were set to court, so we had to set a different date. So we're continuing the case tomorrow, and it's about comments that he made. I believe it was during the election, the last political election, when they actually stood as a party, and they didn't get a lot of support. In fact, I've got the amount here. They got about 19,796 votes out of the whole of South Africa. So it's not an organization that has a lot of support. It's an organization that gets a lot of attention in the media. They regularly get invited to participate in panel discussions, but it's the most extremist, racist organization that I know of in the world. And so this guy, Andile Mlitama, who's their leader, made a political speech where the context is a bit strange. Johan Rupert, the billionaire, spoke at an event where he spoke about, I think he said something, it was probably 2 years ago, about his connections in the taxi industry. Mm-hmm. And then Andile came out and he said, oh, so Johan Rupert, of course, who has a lot of money, is rich, so he's evil, because the BLF is also very communist. And so he then said, oh, so Johan Rupert has meetings, has connections in the taxi industry. So that means that every time a black person is murdered as a result of taxi violence in this section of society, it's actually a murder committed by Johan Rupert, who's this representative of the white people. That's basically his line of reasoning. And then he made this horrific speech about killing 5 whites from now on for every time a black person gets murdered in South Africa. And he said, we're going to kill the whites. We're going to kill their 5 whites every time a black person gets killed. We're going to kill their wives. We're going to kill their children. We're going to kill their dogs. We're going to kill their cats. And he went on like that, which is very obviously a case of hate speech. So we filed a complaint, charges at the Equality Court. The case has already started. I'm actually currently under, still in testimony. I'm still under oath at the moment because I was being examined by our advocate, Mark Oppenheimer, who's an expert in constitutional law and in free speech in particular and in hate speech. He was basically wrapping up when we ran out of time. So I'm still, when we start tomorrow, I'm going to finish my testimony. And then the interesting thing is going to happen is I'm going to be cross-examined on farm murders by the legal representative of Black First Land First. So I'm very interested and curious about what's going to happen there. But that's going to be tomorrow. And the case is on the roll, I think, for 2 days. So I'm sure and I hope that we will wrap it up within 2 days. What we're asking for is a declaration that what he said was hate speech and that a sum of money be paid by him to an organization that works with the victims of farm murders, and that he must issue a public apology for his comments, which of course would be very difficult for him to do. So I don't think we're going to, just in terms of, if we're not going to hear an outcome of the case in 2 days, because the standard procedure is you have the arguments and then usually the judgment is sort of postponed because the judge or the magistrate in this case has to go through the arguments again and write a ruling. So I'm not sure when we'll get that, but hopefully we'll finish the case before the end of this week.
No, that's interesting. You guys have pursued a number of cases against the government, against individuals who misbehaved. And that's, as you mentioned, that's one of the tactics or techniques that you are out there helping support minorities. Someone a bit earlier in the chat said, why doesn't AfriForum drop the tag minority rights and focus on all South Africans? Because you're excluding blacks. The fact that you're focused on minority rights doesn't mean you're excluding black South Africans. They too can support AfriForum. They can support rights for minorities. I mean, here in the United States, black Americans make up 13.5%, but most of the people who are running around, you know, doing things, supporting organizations are actually white Americans for equality for blacks. So, I mean, it's just the inverse there. So there's nothing wrong with that. Matthew Finlayson said, can we get 400 likes? Well, we're a long way from 400 likes. We got 285. So you're going to have to get those 400, 500 people watching right now to start smashing that like button before us get there. And then Jake's Jay asks, can ask Aaron what's this? Oh, ask about a signed copy of Kill the Boer. What's this? Ask Ernst Rhodes, what about a signed copy of Kill the Boer with EFF? I don't get that. That's crazy. And Hans lives in Orania and is a staunch supporter of AfriForum. That's awesome. Hans, I don't know if you started watching the channel after I interviewed Jus Strydom or not. But appreciate you being here. Neil Jeffrey says, just to let you both know, I live abroad and people I meet constantly ask about South Africa and what is happening with the killing of farmers. People are becoming more aware. Well, that's certainly been part of my effort. It's not just the farms. I mean, I'm concerned about South Africans in general. It's truly horrific, the level of violence, the disregard for life. I mean, the execution of underpaid security guards who are doing cash in transit. I just saw another one where a guy was just executed. He offered no resistance, put his hands up, dropped the money, stepped away, and they pushed him to the ground and put a bullet in the back of his head. This is vile. It's out of control. All right, Ernst. So what have you guys got going on? Because in the last couple of months, you've been quite busy with, I mean, of course, the situation in Senegal, the peaceful demonstration took place, and then a few people got a little bit out of hand. One vehicle was turned over. Next thing you know, it's like the Second World War, like a genocide was committed by a small group of South Africans. So that was on the 6th of October. You were there for that, if I'm not mistaken. And then we had the events on the 16th when the second arraignment was supposed to take place. And of course, you know, the EFF went there because it's their mission, not SAPS, not the SANDF, not the intelligence services, not the bureaucracy of South Africa. It is the explicit mission of a political party to protect state property. So, of course, they went to Senegal where they protected state property, except they tore down street signs, smashed concrete rubbish bins, left all the trash on the street. So you guys were there for that as well. I don't know if you guys were did any Black Monday things or events, or if you were at the Witkoist Monument this year, another 53 crosses erected, unfortunately. Have you guys been involved in those things? And if so, what have you got coming up in the near term that people might be able to help out?
Yeah, there was a massive Black Monday gathering in Cape Town. I was actually invited to speak there, and I'm very sad that I wasn't able to, but I had a very good reason not to be there. Is my son was baptized on that day, so I had to excuse myself from that event. But it seems to me to have been a massive success, and we can see that there's a lot more energy among people. I think people, there's been some sort of a change in the psyche of people in this country, minorities and or Afrikaners or farmers or however you want to define them, to feel like maybe we can actually achieve something through showing up at events like this, because we've had these events, repeated events, and they keep getting bigger and bigger. It started, when did it start with Hartswater or Dendron? I think Hartswater was the first one with that triple farm murder. Then there was one at Dendron. There was one at, I'm not even going to remember all of them now by the top of my head. Obviously, Senekal, Bronco Sprite, Delmast. We've had the gathering in at the Witkoist Monument. We've had it in Cape Town. So more and more people are showing up by the thousands at these events in which they protest against farm murders. And it's becoming a hot potato that the South African government doesn't know how to deal with. And that's one of the reasons why we're saying to the state president, well, we need to talk to you about this. There's some practical things that you can do that you aren't doing. So we'll see. But we'll see if we can get that meeting. But I think there's a lot of bad news about South Africa. But part of the good news is we're building up a lot of momentum in this fight. And I think that's something that's worth celebrating.
Well, I agree, absolutely. I think that from what I've seen, definitely since the lockdown was eased a bit back in June and farm attacks have picked up, it's really, but we got to keep the momentum going. We got to make sure the world must know, hashtag the world must know what's happening in South Africa. And so that's been something I've been trying to focus on to get people outside South Africa to know about this. But I'll tell you what, I think one way we can guarantee huge crowds at any event you guys have is I just got to get the Trumpster to come to South Africa. If he comes to South Africa, I mean, listen, this dude was in a rural county in western Pennsylvania yesterday, which barely has, you know, a few tens of thousands of residents. 57,000 people showed up for his rally. And this is when a lot of people are actually genuinely scared of COVID and afraid of getting it. Imagine if there was no COVID. 57,000 people. Joe Biden had 50 people show up and they were all excited about it in the press. They wet their nappies because, ooh, look at that. We're so excited. Trump had 57. That, by the way, he did 5 rallies yesterday. If we could get Trump to come to South Africa, that would certainly draw some attention. That would be amazing.
Yeah. Well, 57,000 people is an incredibly large audience. That's like, it's like the Foo Fighters showing up to play or Metallica arriving. You know, it's a very big show for some of the biggest musicians in the world. So that's, I mean, we'll see what happens with the election, and I'm not trying to make predictions. But we can see even from South Africa that there seems to be, we can see the polls, you know, leaning towards Biden, but they also did with Clinton. But there seems to be this energy at the Trump rallies that's sort of hard to miss, or you should consider that as well. And I think it's, so we'll see what happens with the election, but there's at least there's something happening on ground level. And there's this movement. What we've been describing it as is a mainstream conservative movement across the globe. I'm not talking about crazy right wingers or, you know, Ku Klux Klan groups. It's mainstream moderate conservatives. What I mean by moderate is it's peace loving conservatives who want mutual recognition and respect. They don't want war. They simply want their heritage to be respected and protected, and they want their identity to be protected. They want their history to be respected, and they want respect, and they want to give respect as well. And that's at least that's how I describe the mainstream conservative movement. And it started probably in 2016, or at least most significantly with both Trump and Brexit. And we've had all these, you know, European movements, Party is gaining a lot of support. So it's a reality. And even if Trump loses the election, it's not going to mean that this massive mainstream conservative movement is just going to disappear. It's just growing in support. And we can see that with what people describe as the democratic recession, with countries sort of this backlash. It's not a backlash against democracy. It's a backlash against liberal democracy. And that is just gaining momentum. So we'll see what happens. But I think there's certainly some interesting years ahead for us.
Well, the thing is, this is Ernst, is that the people have gone so far and abandoned the center and even the center left that they're just outrageous radicals. I mean, the traditional liberal, those who believe in traditional liberal beliefs, have become the center and the right. I mean, I'm conservative, but I'm certainly not far to the right. And many of the things that I hold to be valuable are things that I had in common with traditional liberals in the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. But they've lost their frickin' minds. They've lost their minds. They've been drunk with this totalitarian fascist stuff and this scandemic and political nonsense. So the rest of us are kind of stuck here going, we didn't leave the party. Everybody left us. We're, you know, I mean, not the political party, but we rocked up at the party. We rocked up at the Bry and we were all having a good time. And then everybody left. And now they're over there throwing stones at us and burning down our house and calling us names. What happened?
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. And I mean, we've seen it. We keep seeing it in the mainstream media where I was in a television interview the other day and I made the comment about, I sort of in passing, I said AfriForum is a moderate organization. You know, we're not a crazy right wing group. You can call us conservative, nationalist. As a matter of fact, we've explicitly rejected white nationalism. You can look it up.
Yep.
And you know, we condemn all forms of racism, white racism, black racism alike. And I'm sort of in passing made a comment that we're a moderate group, and the journo. That's the issue. That's the thing I said that he took issue with. He said, I have a problem with you describing yourself as a moderate group, and we'll have to have a separate discussion about that. But I mean, it's a strange thing where if your view isn't openly left wing, then you are regarded as a far right winger. That's the crazy situation we're in. But it's not sustainable, and that's why there's this backlash. And they don't understand the backlash. They don't understand why people are voting for Trump. They don't understand why people in the UK don't want to be in the European Union. They don't understand it. It's because they don't know how crazy they are in the first place. That's the problem.
Well, again, it comes back to the point I think we made at the beginning is these people are detached from reality. Not all of them. Some of them know exactly what they're doing and they just don't care because they profit from the confusion. They profit from the chaos. They profit in many ways, financially and political power. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it too. All right. So I'd love to keep you for hours more, but I'm not going to do that to you. That's unfair because I want to get you back. So, I mean, if I keep you for 3 hours, then Ronaldo will win the argument. Oh, Chris Wyatt has these marathon streams. He never lets people off his channel. Ronaldo Jose. Ekwacha. All right. So this is for the benefit of AfriForum as well. So Kate Cross asked this question. She said, "Hey, I'm signed up with AfriForum and do donate. What else can the average South African citizen do to help?" And I think that's the last question we'll ask you there, Ernst. What else can people do to help out the situation in South Africa and AfriForum in particular?
Well, if you're in South Africa, the first thing you can do is you can become a member, but you can also become involved. You can become involved through one of our branches. We've got some exciting things coming up with how we plan on making a bigger impact on ground level and strengthening our local structures. But through these structures, we also have national conferences and congresses where we all get together as members and all the representatives from all over the country. And we have annual general meetings. And through that, people can become more involved. Maybe that, I think that would be my main recommendation. And if you don't live in South Africa, you can join through Friends of AfriForum. And regardless of whether you're in South Africa or outside of South Africa, the main thing or one of the main things that you can do to help is just to raise awareness, to talk about this issue, to write to your, if you're in the US, for example, you can write to your representative. In South Africa, it doesn't help, right? You can write to the ANC if you want, but you can write to some of the opposition parties and ask them to raise this issue in parliament. You can write to your newspaper. You can comment in comment sections. You can subscribe to channels such as these and support people who raise awareness. There's a lot that you can do just to help spread the word about the problem. And the more we can spreading the word alone isn't sufficient, but spreading the word is the most important first step that we can take to get to some practical solutions.
I think that's excellent. Appreciate that very much. Well, Ernst Roetz, it's a pleasure to have you on the channel. Hopefully when I get to South Africa, we can link up. If you get back to Washington, I'm close to Washington, we can touch base. And I can tell you which swamp creatures to avoid when you're down in the swamp. But anyway, thank you so much. I'm glad we finally got you on the channel. And we didn't really talk much about Senecal and specifically about farmers. We talked in general about those. So maybe we can talk about those events or whatever the events of the day are next time we get together. But anyway, you're welcome back anytime on the channel if you want to come on here. And the good news is that while a lot of my subscriber base has been South African, and I'm very grateful for that, it's awesome. The number of folks here in the U.S. has been growing a lot recently. I did the Trump live stream last night, and I was amazed at how many Americans were watching the stream last night when I did that. So it's just good news, because the more Americans are watching, the more become aware of this, the more they talk to the representatives and raise this issue. And one thing is certain, we can't say this about South African politics, but members of Congress who have to run for office every 2 years tend to be very attentive to their constituents who make a lot of noise. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. No doubt about that here in the United States. Anyway, Ernst, thanks a lot. Any last comments you'd like to say before you head out?
No, maybe I can just stress what you've said, because I've witnessed it firsthand. I can't remember if it was in the House or the Senate, but one of the representatives we spoke with was actually a staff member, mm-hmm. not the representative himself, who said that we're so glad to have AfriForum and to speak with you, because we've already received 3 emails from our constituents asking us what are we going to do about farm murders. And the fact that only 3 emails can make such an impact, it shows how big an impact you can make. If we can get people by their hundreds to write to their senators to say, listen, we want you to express your concern about what's happening in South Africa. We don't want you to declare war or do anything drastic. Just at least make a public statement and say, listen, there's a problem in South Africa. That alone is already a lot that will give a lot of momentum. So we've seen it. We've spoken with people in Washington who have said to us, we are now going to write back to these constituents and say to them, we had a meeting with AfriForum and this is what we, what we discussed, and this is what we think we can do. So it really makes a difference. If you're in the US, it makes a big difference if you write to your constituents, if you write to your representative at least, and ask them to make us to take a stance on this issue.
Absolutely. So rugby fan?
Actually, I'm not so much a team sportman. I'm a skateboarding fan.
Oh, okay.
But the extent to which I watch rugby, I am a Bulls fan. Yes.
It was an assumption on my part.
You've got the right jersey on.
It was an assumption.
Yes.
All right, Ernst. Bye-bye, donkey. It was a pleasure having you on the channel. I appreciate us finally being able to get together, and to your friend there, that Oak the Conscious Caracal, thanks for needling him and reminding him a couple of times to come on the channel. So I'm grateful for that. Anyway, we'll catch you next time, and good luck with AfriForum, and let's hope that people get their act together and send the message to the ANC in 2021 municipal elections that enough is enough. It's time to govern or move on. Anyway, that's my thoughts.
Thank you very much.
Well, folks, thanks for tuning in. This has been pretty awesome. Okay, now it's e-begging time. All right, where are the subscriptions? There are so many people here who are watching the stream. I know you're not all subscribers to Chris White Africa. Trust me, you'll enjoy the content here. It doesn't cost anything. Go ahead and become a subscriber right down there, and you might be surprised by some of the content you find. I talk about business. I talk about defense, security, culture, promote Afrikaans language, Afrikaans music, but not just that. Promote music in general and culture in general. A big affinity for Afrikaans and for Tswana, or Setswana, as we call it in Botswana, and also for the Basutu people. So we promote all of those groups here on the channel and Africa in general. So cover all the continents. So feel free to become a subscriber. And the likes, we're getting close. Wow, I didn't think we were 270, I think, or 260 when someone mentioned, can we get to 400 likes? We're at 379 likes, folks. If we can get there, push it up to 400, that'd really be really awesome. And thank you so much. For the super chats, there were a few super chats here. I think it was Phil that asked me if I could donate the super chats. I won't donate super chats, because then it'll be even less money. But what I'll do is I'll take a look at maybe if we can't do something to help them out. And maybe in the future, if people want that, we can do a stream in which we talk about a big topic with Off Reform. And then what we can do is maybe donate those super chats. But for those who don't know, YouTube takes 30% of super chats. So the amount you give, if I give that amount, then I'll give more. Well, actually, I had quite a few super chats here. Just they're smaller ones. But Flying Board gave a super chat early on about Aaron's going to the States. Then Shane gave a super chat. Flying Board gave another one about changing the street to Hendrik Verwoerd. That was funny. DC Sylvester Stallone gave one. And then Flying Boar, Malcolm Stark, Flying Boar had another one. And Gopalang Lakota said, what do you think of John Steenhuisen? I'm sorry I didn't get to ask that question there. My apologies for Gopalang. I can try to ask his thoughts on Steenhuisen, but I'm going to guess it's probably a positive view of John Steenhuisen, who was just yesterday elected formally as a leader of the Opposition Democratic Alliance in South Africa. So there you go, folks. All right. People are fleeing the stream right now because they've heard what they want to hear. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm not sure if I'll do a Night Owls edition tonight. I'm still preparing for teaching the Department of Commerce tomorrow. Remember, tomorrow is going to be a pretty crazy day because I won't be available till evening for South Africa time. Thank you, Adrian Tysa, for just subscribing there, because I'll be teaching in the morning and then we have the elections. But I will be on tomorrow on my channel. I may potentially be on Joe Emilio's channel, as well as Ode Moja's conversation about the elections. And I'll be live streaming the election results at 7:15, 19:15 tomorrow Eastern Standard Time, which will be early morning in South Africa and Botswana. But feel free to Ben Hashem says, I feel sick to my stomach. I watched 5 minutes of Biden rally. No, it's fun to watch a Biden rally. Yeah, so just go to joeohio.com/XPYZ. You know the thing. It's Joe at text Joe 300700030. Yeah. Corn pop. Yeah, it is quite painful to watch. And he just makes up words. And so I was talking about da ba da ba da ba. What did he just say? I was talking about da ba da ba da ba. What the hell did he just say? No idea. Folks, it's really sad. I think it's elder abuse. Someone should take care of that gentleman and get him the care he needs. Hopefully that care will be not with a White House physician. We'll leave that in the hands of Donald John Trump for them. Well, thanks for tuning in, folks. 398 likes. Wow, we are so close, on the verge, right on the precipice, leaning over. I feel like a meerkat. By the way, did anybody see the meerkat? Do you guys see the meerkat? Right back there is a meerkat. Check that out. TM just subscribed. Thank you for subscribing. See the meerkat back there? I put a meerkat. That was the Easter egg. Anyway, so. All right. Thanks, folks. Nearly 2 hours on the stream. Thank you. God bless you. My many thanks to my special feature guest today, Ernst Ritz. It was a long journey to get you on the channel because you're a busy guy. But thank you for coming on the channel. Really appreciate it. We were all over the place because of the telecommunications problems on your end. But we did get to the topics that were critically important here. Also talking about your court case tomorrow. Good luck in the court case and the cross-examination from the attorney from the other side. That should be entertaining, to say the least. Excuse me. Erica loves meerkats. Yeah, meerkats are really, really cool. Meerkat Manor, that's a pretty cool show. I enjoy that one. Sideliner Opinion says, if the Americans choose Biden as next president, my estimation, Americans in general will take a big knock. Yeah, well, you're not alone, Sideliner. I'll be shaking my head going, what is wrong with people? Food streaming in for Burn Farms at Bosov. Yeah, thank you, Andre Hartsleaf. I appreciate that at Bosov. Thank you for sharing that. Anyway, folks, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. We're down about 300 people, so I'm going to drop out of here. Thanks for 412 likes. Thank you for the super chats, the people I just mentioned. And thank you to my guest, one Ernst Ritz from Off Reform. Thank you so much for that, folks. God bless and have a good day. We're going to wrap it out here. And I'll be back for a little bit later on tonight with the Night Owls edition.